Court of Appeals. I see we have lawyers from San Antonio and Houston with us today. Thank you for coming up to be with us. We have two cases set for oral argument this morning. The first is Andrew Nellums versus BNSF Railway Company. And then we're going to have a panel change, so we'll take a short recess of about 10 minutes, and then we will hear the Denton County Electric Cooperative case. So I will ask Megan, our Chief Deputy Clerk, to call the first case. Are you ready?
May it please the court. In this FELA case, the trial court omitted key language in the jury charge, a key instruction. What was submitted, as pointed out in BNSF's brief, is an instruction stating that negligence is a legal cause of damage if it played any part, no matter how small, in bringing about or actually causing the injury or damage. And BNSF's position is that that was sufficient to send the jury the message of the lighter burden of proof and the different proximate cause standard incorporated within the FELA scheme. However, what was left out, which is critical, that should have followed that portion that I just read, is the part that said, if you find that the defendant, BNSF Railway Company, was negligent and that the defendant's negligence contributed in any way toward any injury or damage suffered by the plaintiff, you must find that such injury or damage was legally caused by the defendant BNSF Railway Company's acts or omissions. The submission in this case, due to that omission, had the effect of directing the jury to decide this case under a common law proximate cause standard rather than the FELA standard, and I'll explain how. Additionally, it eliminated the absolute, FELA departed from the common law in the sense that it replaced the common law standard of causation with the in whole or in part causation. It also removed the absolute bar or absolute defense of contributory negligence and assumption of the risk, so that those defenses, although they can play a role in the FELA case, they aren't an absolute bar. And if the plaintiff is alleged to be, and there is evidence of the plaintiff's negligence that should be submitted to the jury, it cannot be used to take away, it can only be used to limit or lower the plaintiff's damages, not a complete bar to recovery. And our position is that the omission of the instruction that I've referenced had the effect of putting the jury in a position without any guidance about how to deal with the evidence, for instance, that Nellums fouled the track when he was walking in between the tracks, which I believe that BNSF either, I'm not sure if that, our position is that was not really evidence of his negligence. At least under the law of FELA, it wasn't an unreasonable action, which is how they define the negligence of the plaintiff. And so what we have is a situation where the jury has just an instruction that negligence is the legal cause of damage if it played any part, no matter how small, in bringing about or actually causing the injury or damage. But there's no tie of that instruction to the defendant's actions, which is the whole purpose of FELA. It's to make it clear, and it's been determined over the case law that's interpreted this act, that essentially it's this, I call it a featherweight burden. And really what I mean by that is that there's no contributory negligence defense. And so whether the plaintiff engaged in some negligence or not only means that his damages are reduced. With the way that the jury charge was given to the jury, there was no vehicle for the jury to understand that, be instructed.
Why would the jury need to understand that? In a normal case, the jury doesn't understand that. Judge applies the law, and if they found the plaintiff more than 50% at fault, he gets nothing.
So that's That's true, and I want, although I'm talking in a certain way, I don't want the court to think I'm saying the jury should have been informed of the meaning of its answers. What I'm really trying to say is that this is different from most of those kinds of cases. As the court probably knows, for example, I think this is very similar to how workman's comp cases are not allowed to be submitted under the proportionate responsibility scheme. You don't submit the plaintiff in those cases because statutorily our legislature, state legislature, has decided that similarly these defenses aren't applicable to bar recovery in that case. Whether the plaintiff should be submitted in a FELA case, that hasn't been decided in the same way that the legislature has decided it shouldn't happen workman's comp. But my point by mentioning that is to say that it's a very tricky situation because unlike in a normal, say, a personal injury case that doesn't involve FELA or workman's comp, then yes, you have the plaintiff, his or her negligence is submitted if there's evidence of it, and the jury simply has to apportion responsibility because it's just a matter of plain normal negligence with the normal common law proximate cause standard and normal defenses, unless any of them have been shown to not be valid by summary judgment or some other reason. But in a FELA case, it's not like that. So what's happened, I believe, is that the jury is given this question that just says, did the negligence of either of these individuals, well, the company or Nellums, cause his injuries, without the added required instruction that conveys the important purpose of FELA, that any negligent act of the defendants, in any part, is going to be the legal. If it's the legal cause of his injuries, then the defendant is negligent, and then the next step should be, as shown in the Fifth Circuit's proposed or suggested jury charge, is an instruction about contributory negligence to explain to the jury what happens. And I attached a copy of that to my brief in an Appendix C, and the court can see that the Fifth Circuit specifically suggests including an instruction that says, it's near the bottom of this page, the defendant contends that the plaintiff was negligent and that such negligence was a legal cause of the plaintiff's injury. The defendant bears the burden of proving that negligence. And it says what they're supposed to prove to show that the plaintiff was negligent. And then it goes on to explain that the plaintiff won't be barred from recovery if the jury finds that there's negligence and that his recovery will only be reduced. And I think that that's important because if the jury isn't given an outlet, either an explanation or possibly we didn't complain about the way the questions were submitted. So, it's difficult for me to explain exactly how the jury charge should have looked, but I think that instruction could have saved and prevented this problem because it would have made clear to the jury that if they looked at the evidence and they saw what they saw, you know, for instance, suppose they thought that fouling the track was negligence on the part of Nellums. I think that if they thought that, with the jury charge they had to decide, they had to look and see, well, did either one of their negligence cause this injury? And the way it was given, they didn't get the emphasis on the defendant's actions, the defendant's negligence, and I think that that's the part that's missing. Because without the emphasis on defendant as set out in the pattern jury charges and some of these other cases that we've both cited in our briefs, then it just leaves the jury to default to a normal common law proximate cause, and it also interferes with the intended effect of abolishing the contributory negligence bar on recovery in FELA.
So you're saying that the instruction that was submitted was, I think you used these words, was not tied to the defendant, and there was no instruction as to the plaintiff's contributory negligence?
Right, and I must say that we did not submit a contributory negligence question, probably because we didn't think one should have been submitted. But yes, I think that is the key, is that if one looks at the courts talking about a proper jury charge and you look at the Fifth Circuit's jury charge, that is the problem that stands out, because all of them continue with an instruction saying, if you find that the defendant was negligent, and they go on. And I think that's the best way to express the FILO standard, is to identify the defendant again and say that it's the defendant's actions. What it says, if you find that the defendant was negligent and that the defendant's negligence contributed in any way toward any injury or damage suffered by the plaintiff, you must find that such injury or damage was legally caused by the defendant's act or omission. Left alone, the first part just says negligence is a legal cause of damage if it played any part, no matter how small, in bringing about or actually causing the injury or damage. That's all we had in the instruction here. And that is just not enough to help to instruct the jury of the FILA standard of causation.
Maybe I'm a simpleton for purposes of this case. I just don't get it. Maybe if you put it in lay language for me. I just don't. The jury is sitting there, and it says that on page 3 of the appendix here, if negligence played any part in bringing back or causing the injury, it's causation. Now, that's what this other instruction says, only this is defendant plaintiff neutral, and the instruction, as you, to use your words, emphasizes the negligence of the defendant. Which, just right there, I would be scratching my head, just like if it emphasized the negligence of the plaintiff, I would say, well, I don't think you're supposed to emphasize the negligence of either party. That's for the jury to decide. In fact, it's a comment on the evidence, it seems to me. Are you telling me that obviously we don't have a lot of FILA cases up here on appeal. Are you telling me that on FILA cases, that there's an emphasis in the charge on the defendant's negligence and no corresponding emphasis on the plaintiff's negligence?
I do believe that. I may not be articulating it very well, but I believe that's the purpose of FILA, because it has taken away the absolute. It's
right,
basically
the 50% bar, right?
Right.
The old way of doing it before.
Well, and more than that, I believe. I mean, I believe that it's more than just making it like other cases we have now. I mean, that's the situation in pretty much any case. If the 50% bar is gone. However, I believe that FILA has gone further, and essentially its purpose is to take away all the defenses of the employer. I mean, they can put on evidence of contributory negligence for purposes of lowering their liability if they lose. But that's it. And so, again, I may not be saying it very well, but I think that there is a distinction, and that the courts have said the proximate cause standard the normal proximate cause standard is not the standard in FILA. And it's true that.
Or
plaintiff or defendant?
That's true. You're right. It is. It is a lessened burden for both of them. However, the impact that it has on the defendant is more significant, I think. And I think that that's what the jury charge is supposed to convey.
And why is that?
Because the lessened burden to show negligence of the plaintiff, I believe, doesn't come with the same impact that it does for the defendant, i.e., the plaintiff cannot be held negligent, I mean, as far as awarding damages against them in a FILA case, but also it can't bar recovery completely. It's not a complete defense anymore. It just lessens the recovery if the jury finds that that the plaintiff wins. Whereas with the defendant, it's a standard of if you did anything, if you did any little thing that contributed. You know, there are cases that used to talk about the being a substantial cause or something like that, substantial part of the cause. And the courts have said that even trying to put it that way is too high of a burden. There's one case, I think, that went to the Supreme Court that working in a railroad where there was this swampy, watery area where there were dead animals and bugs flying around, and the guy got bitten by one of the bugs, and his leg got infected, and eventually both of his legs had to be amputated. And ultimately, the Supreme Court of the United States found that this substantial cause way of looking at it, charging the jury, was not correct because it put too high of a burden on the plaintiff in a FELA case. And I think that's kind of where I'm coming from. That's what we're getting at, is that it makes it, although it does say if it played any part, no matter how small, we believe that the inclusion of the section which talks about the defendant and focuses on the defendant is important given the FELA scheme. And again, I mean, I don't believe that it's a comment on the evidence to put it that way, because the Fifth Circuit has, and other courts have already approved exactly this kind of an instruction that includes an instruction pointing out the defendant. And I think that that's a key part for this case.
Well, tell me, when you get to start again, tell me how, under the facts of this case, removing ourselves from theory and returning to the real world, walking down the track and stepping on this tie plate that was propped up, and I remember because I worked on the railroad for 5 years, how that this instruction altered the jury, would have changed the jury's answer to question number one about negligence of Burlington Northern.
Okay, I will.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Your honors, my name is LaVon Hovnatanyan, and along with Mr. Wayne L. Robbins, Jr., who's the senior general attorney for BNSF, I represent the appellee in this case. There are several independent reasons this court should affirm the judgment. The first is, while BNSF does not agree that FELA really imposes a so-called featherweight burden of causation on the plaintiff, we're certainly willing to play by those rules today.
Because, why do you not agree with that?
Well, Your Honor, we don't agree because, essentially, going back to the United States Supreme Court case of Sorrell in 2007, the court made two pronouncements in that case that are significant. The first answers Ms. Davidson's argument on whether the defendant has a higher standard of care or a higher burden, and the court said he doesn't. The court was very careful to point out it should be the same. The second reason is because the Sorrell court, the majority opinion, says FELA changed things in only one way, and that was with express statutory language. Whatever FELA didn't change with express statutory language stayed as it was in the common law. And the common law, in a case like this, requires a standard proximate cause instruction, which is the one that BNSF submitted. Now, the trial court rejected it.
Even though the Act says otherwise?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
Does the Act say otherwise, if it played any part, no matter how small?
Well, but Your Honor, that's not language that comes right out of the Act, though. That's not language that comes right out of FELA. That language has been taken in cases that we think are not correctly reasoned, okay, to say that the plaintiff has a lower, not negligence cause of action, like the other side argues, but a lower causation standard. Now, while we disagree, again, we're willing to play by that rule book because we prevailed at trial.
Good.
And, well, okay, there you go.
Good
so
call.
We're 10 yards down the road on that then, so we won't fight that fight. But the cases that we cited in our brief, most recently Monroe, from the Middle District of Louisiana just a few months ago, and the case that came from the Fifth Circuit in 1985, Smith, all say that if you want to describe the purported featherweight burden, the way to do it is with the phrase, played any part, no matter how small, which is exactly the phrase that the trial court used. So that's the first reason this court can affirm, because in fact, while it wasn't phrased exactly like the plaintiff would have had it in this case, that is the message that went to the jury. The Texarkana Court of Appeals in 1989 said in the Blakely case, when you're dealing with FELA and you're dealing with jury instructions, the point is not the specific words. The point is the message. And the trial court doesn't have to convey the message the way the plaintiff wants it or the way the defendant wants it. He just has to convey it within his vast discretion the way the law says it should be. And in this case, according to the plaintiff's own theory of the case, that is precisely what the trial court did. Under Blakely, that cannot be an abuse of discretion. The second reason is that the Texas Supreme Court decided a case in 1990 called Mitchell, where they gave guidance to trial courts and appellate courts on what a FELA charge should look like in a Texas court. In the Mitchell case, they quote the charge and they call it succinct, well-drafted, and they approve it. In Mitchell, the language that is used as far as the played any part, no matter how small, is identical to the instruction that the trial court gave the jury in this case, with one irrelevant exception. The one in Mitchell begins with the phrase, for the purposes of this action, which obviously is non-substantive, doesn't make any difference. But aside from that, what the trial court gave the jury in this case is word for word what the Mitchell court in 1990 said should go to the jury. And that's the second reason this court should affirm. Now, in 2002, the Texas Supreme Court came along in Williams, their next big FELA case, and they said, we reaffirm, their exact word, we reaffirm our discussion of causation in Mitchell. And, of course, that's what this case is about, causation. And they reversed Mitchell to the limited extent that they said, we didn't get the foreseeability and the duty instructions exactly right. Of course, those aren't issues in this appeal. So we respectfully suggest that just as Mitchell was viable in 1990 on the issue of causation, and again in 2002 on the issue of causation, so should it be today as well. And that's the law, the way the Texas Supreme Court laid it out. The third reason the court should affirm is just one where I'm not going to cite a case or refer to an act. It just appears to be common sense that the phrase played any part, no matter how small, means the same thing as contributed in any way. Now, if the court agrees, if those two things are essentially the same, if those phrases mean the same thing, certainly there's no need for the trial court to tell it to the jury twice. And once was sufficient, as it was in Mitchell and in all the federal cases that we've cited in our brief, which I won't go through. They mean the same thing. And if the court agrees, then I hope the court will also agree the trial court does not need to say it back to back the way that Mr. Nellum's charge would have had the court do. The next reason is certainly less interesting than FELA or the Texas Supreme Court's pronouncements or the United States Supreme Court opinion in Sorrell. It's old-fashioned waiver. We believe this particular point was waived. It was waived at the charge conference, and I'll explain how. Mr. Nellums had submitted the charge that he wanted the jury to get several days before trial. At the charge conference, the court asked Mr. Nellums, what are your objections? His first objection was to the fact that the introductory section of his instruction was left out. Trial court said, very good, and then she overruled his objection. Mr. Nellum's second objection was to the damages portion. And the trial court said, well, you've got some good points. Let's talk about this. And they went off the record. When they came back on the record, Judge Womack asked, all right, are you now satisfied on the damages point? Anything else there? And Mr. Nellum's counsel said, no, I'm fine. I like that the way it is. And then the following transpired. The trial court asked, do you have any other objections to the court's charge? To which Mr. Nellum's counsel responded, no, Your Honor. And the judge then said, well, then, I'm ready for the defendant's objections. We suggest that under KH, under Rule 33.1, under pretty much any standard, when the lawyer looks the judge in the eye and says, that's all I have, I'm fine with it, the way it is except for that, I have no more objections, the trial court is entitled to conclude he doesn't have any more objections. And so there's no problem with me submitting this charge to the jury the way it is, okay, with the one exception that he has successfully objected to the introductory section being omitted. But that's all. And of course, the whole point of waiver is not to be cruel or not to judge, but the point of waiver is that you don't let something unfair happen to the trial court. The trial court has to have the opportunity to correct the alleged error before the Court of Appeals said, you're wrong and you have to do it over. And in this case, we think it's textbook waiver when the lawyer looks the judge in the face and says, no, Your Honor, I don't have any more objections. So we suggest under KH, under the rules of civil procedure, pretty much 271 through 279, which address how this kind of error has to be preserved, and certainly under Rule 33.1, that error has not been preserved on that. The last point I want to talk about very briefly is from Sorrell, which Mr. Robbins is going to fuss at me because I've now said Sorrell two or three times, and I know that's not the right way to pronounce it. In Sorrell, the court was very careful to point out FELA is to protect employees of railroads. FELA is to protect people, okay, who work for railroads engaged in interstate commerce. And Congress did that when they passed the act. But the court was careful to say the playing field is still level. Nothing got lighter for the plaintiff or lighter for the defendant. In fact, the burden of proof is still preponderance of the evidence, as it is in every other civil action in the country. And the court was careful to say Congress went as far as they said in the act and no further. And there's a really good concurrence in that case written by Justice Souter and joined by two other justices where he emphasized the fact that the court had said before and that when FELA speaks, FELA controls. If FELA doesn't speak to the issue, common law controls. And he even said, remember, in Gottschall, the previous case, the court cataloged exactly what it was that FELA undid. Everything else, we go with the common law. And part of that everything else is the causation standard. And the court may agree or disagree with that interpretation of Sorrell. We certainly think it's correct. Other courts certainly think it's correct. But for the purposes of this case, for all the reasons I discussed, you can affirm. They all have the root in the same principle that contributed in any way means essentially the same thing as played any part, no matter how small. So for those reasons, despite the fact we think the trial court played by the wrong rule book, we'll take that rule book and we ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Is there any rebuttal, Ms. Davidson?
Yes.
Good.
May it please the court. Regarding what Sorrell said about the burden, I just want to point out that Justice Ginsburg actually said that she believed that the majority opinion was leaving in place precedent solidly establishing that the causation standard in FELA actions is more relaxed than in tort litigation generally. So I do believe that even the Sorrell case supports the position that there's a lighter standard. And I agree, it's for both parties. In answer to Justice McCoy's question of how this instruction would have changed things. The evidence in this case was that Mr. Nellums, as the court I'm sure knows, had come out of the train. He was supposed to do some switches, and it was a dark field. He tripped on this tie while he was apparently walking down the center of the tracks. And at trial, Vinson, the representative of BNSF, the only person who testified on behalf of BNSF at trial, I believe, testified that it was a hazardous condition. He said that Nellums wasn't charged with any rule violations. He said it was not common to find tie plates in the track there, that it was the railroad's job to maintain the track and the walking areas. And the only thing that he had to say that was negative about Nellum's actions on that night was that he walked up the middle of the track when he was working. However, Vincent also agreed that under BNSF rules that Nellums was entitled to use the safest course to accomplish his work that evening. There was no light in the yard. Nellums had complained about it several times, although not in writing, admittedly. And so as a result, if the jury had been instructed properly, then I believe that they would have focused on these things without being which is the evidence of the defendant's negligence, if any. Any little tiny thing that the defendant did, and they would have focused on these things. There was no other evidence or testimony presented at trial that contradicted Nellum's testimony about the accident or that complained about any of his actions. There was only one statement, and it was that he walked up the center line, which our position is that that wasn't even evidence of his negligence based on the evidence presented at trial.
No, and the defendant, the jury did not find that he was negligent.
That's true. I think that, and of course, I'm not in the minds of the jury. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but our position is that there was that evidence, and they got the, if any, part of the instruction, and they didn't know what to do with it because they thought, and it does apply to the plaintiff and the defendant, but they didn't know what to do with it because there is supposed to be under FELA an emphasis on the defendant because it is a lesser burden. And the negligence of the plaintiff is only to go to lessening damages if damages are awarded. One thing about the Mitchell charge that that Mr. Hovnatanian was talking about is that I think that that charge also shows that there's a problem with this charge because although, as he says, there was this instruction below it that's like what was done in this case, it was preceded by a four-part instruction that said, in order to prevail on this claim, the plaintiff must prove each of the following. And it listed, and it talks about the defendant is a common carrier. The defendant was negligent as claimed by the plaintiff, and that negligence was a legal cause of damage sustained by the plaintiff. And then it includes the instruction that was included in our charge. And admittedly, it does not include the part that was omitted from our charge. However, I think it's important that, again, even in Mitchell, there's a clear instruction to the jury that sets out the elements in FELA so that they can see that they need to focus on the defendant and the plaintiff's cause of action instead of this other just, I think that they got confused as a result. And I think that Mitchell shows in another way that there needs to be an instruction that focuses on the actions of the defendant and the defendant's negligence for the jury to understand the FELA burden and apply it properly.
How do you deal with KH?
Oh, well, what I would say is that there's another case which is cited in my brief, and the rule talk about how when you have an instruction and you submit an instruction, that's sufficient, and you don't have to object again later. And I understand what they're saying about looking the trial court in the eye and saying I have no objections, but I don't think that that eradicates or removes all the instructions the instructions that you submitted. I don't think that that means that just because you submitted instructions, the court isn't going to use them, and that the formal charge conference, once everything's been discussed and you say I have no more objections, I don't believe that means that all of your other objections and the instructions you submitted are therefore irrelevant, waiving everything that you've done before.
Thank you, counsel, for your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for traveling up here to present your case to us. Good briefs. Your case is submitted, and you'll be hearing from the court when our opinion is issued. Thank you very much. You're dismissed. And the court will stand in recess for 10 minutes.
All rise.